I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The Washington Post is reporting that the Biden administration is working with private companies to develop a vaccine passport, a credential on your smartphone or a printed document that would prove that you have been vaccinated against coronavirus. This could allow you to travel and do many of the activities that have been off limits during the pandemic. The EU has announced plans for a, quote, digital green certificate that would open up those countries to summer travelers, and other countries are doing similar things. How would this certificate work? What about privacy and equity issues? And why are some Republicans pushing back hard against it? Joining us is Dan Diamond. He covers health and policy for The Washington Post and wrote those articles that I referenced in my introduction. Dan Diamond, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, thanks for having me and for reading those articles in the Washington Post.
That's part of my job. But I appreciate you your coverage, and I want to just pick it apart as quickly and as efficiently as we can during this segment. What would this vaccine passport, what kind of information would it include as you understand it?
As I understand it, the vaccine passports that are under development, and there are quite a few being developed, not just in the United States, but around the world, would include proof of vaccination. They might link to electronic health records or your record of being vaccinated. They might link to some personal identification. But it is important to say that the U.S. government is not planning to be the holder of the data. It's not planning to issue the passports itself. They're just looking, government officials are looking at setting the standards to make sure that these passports in collecting the data, that they are protecting people's privacy, that they're done in a way that will be accessible to as many people who want them as needed.
I noticed that the word passport seems to have some baggage. There's words, maybe it should be called a certificate or some kind of verification. What's the language battle that's going on here?
That's a great and timely question, because passport has become politicized. I was talking to Frank Luntz, a longtime Republican pollster, about this last night. He said he's polling around whether the word passport even makes sense, and if that, for folks who might see that as something elite, that not all Americans have international passports, could there be a better option? I think the reason it became such a go-to here, Marty, is because passports do apply to travel, and in a lot of cases, these certificates would be used when trying to travel abroad or maybe take a cruise. So I think that's where it came from. And yes, the Biden administration, when it talks about this, tries very hard not to say the word passport. They try and talk about credentials or verification of someone's vaccine status.
Where is this coming from? As you said, the Biden administration working with businesses and companies and organizations, is the travel industry, which of course has been hit so hard by the pandemic, are they one of the drivers behind this idea?
The travel industry is absolutely a major driver, though there are fractures inside the travel industry. I talked to folks at Carnival Cruise Lines, which oversaw the Diamond Princess, the Grand Princess. Some of your listeners may remember that those ships were epicenters of coronavirus outbreaks last year. But Carnival executives say they're not sure they want to require proof of vaccination. But a lot of other cruise lines do, and other airlines and other travel companies are thinking about it as well. There are private sector firms like Walmart that have signaled they might be interested in this too. It's still too early to say where it might be required and in what cases, but there's considerable interest in just making travel and commerce as safe as possible, and this could be a path to improve safety.
Is there any thought about making it mandatory, or are we sort of too early in the thinking process?
That's a good question. The idea of mandating a passport across the United States has been ruled out. Biden officials have said to me over and over and over again, we don't have the power to do this. We're not going to do this. And I know that that's been a fear that Republicans have really played up. And the way that I think about it, Marty, is like masks. The Biden administration supports the idea of masks. They want people to wear masks to be protected. The president, as much as he likes masks, can't order all Americans to wear masks, but he can encourage it. His administration can set standards around safe masks. There is some similarity to the passports. The administration can't tell every American or every business, you have to start using these. We're not China. We're not some of the countries overseas that are pursuing this. but it can try and make the passports that are coming as safe as possible. And there are businesses that might require it, certainly, for their employees, for their customers. You can imagine that people who might be working in very safe or very secure areas, places where you might be cooped up together for long periods of time, those businesses, those agencies might impose their own vaccination requirements.
We are, we're making, frankly, I think, extraordinary progress when it comes to getting people vaccinated. But clearly, we've got a long way to go. There are people that don't want to be vaccinated for a whole host of reasons. There are people who are sort of cut off from easy access to vaccinations. What are some of the equity issues that we need to struggle with?
Yeah, the pace of vaccination has been terrific. And I think America and Americans should take a real feel incredibly proud that our country has done so well on the rollout. At the same time, the fact that we're vaccinating so many people in America raises equity questions around the globe. We have gobbled up so many vaccines that other countries have yet to get. And then in America, there is this split where folks who tend to be more well off, who maybe haven't been as afflicted by the virus, are disproportionately likely to get vaccinated. And that raises concerns that people who might be able to demonstrate proof of vaccination, it will reward those better off Americans who are able to get access to vaccines and continue to punish Americans who might be lower income or might be in communities of color that have had more trouble getting vaccinated and further widening equity gaps. Mm-hmm. The issue of smartphones as potentially an equity issue, too, I know this has come up, that if you're displaying on a smartphone your vaccine certificate, that would penalize some Americans. I've heard from enough public health experts who say probably not, just given how ubiquitous smartphones are. And again, this idea that one could print out the vaccination certificate and present that instead of a smartphone.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you and make sure our listeners can join our conversation. That's Dan Diamond. He covers health policy and politics for The Washington Post and has been writing about this idea coming not just from the Biden administration, but from a number of private companies to develop a vaccine passport, for lack of a better word, or for certificate or verification in order to help open up the country's economy. What do you think about that? Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dan, as you said, there's a lot of thinking going on and a lot of, I guess, ideas that are floating around. Is there a timetable for whatever we're calling this thing that we're talking about?
So the vaccine credentialing effort has been underway inside the Biden administration for some weeks. I obtained some internal documents from meetings earlier in March where hundreds of officials across dozens of agencies were being pulled together to try and figure out what is the best approach here. The resulting guidelines that are coming from the administration are probably still weeks away. I know that they want to wait until more people are vaccinated to weigh in on what the vaccination passports should look like, what the standards mm-hmm. could be. They also are dealing with, again, all of these different private sector groups, international coalitions that may be releasing their own vaccine passports on their own timetables. So I think we'll end up seeing a bit of a staggered approach where, like in the state of New York, there is a vaccine passport initiative already underway, working with IBM. But in other parts of the country, vaccine passport initiatives and pilots are probably still some time off.
But is there a need for something universal, something that is recognized by everybody and not just every state, but every country in the world? Is there, you know, sort of like our regular passport, something that is recognized wherever you go?
Well, that's exactly the issue. And that's why the Biden administration says it's involved, because if you have, we found 17 different initiatives that the Biden administration was looking at earlier this month. If you have 17 different vaccine passports, that could create real credentialing issues and which one is vetted where. So what the Biden administration is pushing for, and this is a little wonky, but they want what's known as open source code, where the coding, the software coding behind these digital certificates is open and available and can be easily replicated, as opposed to really proprietary code, like a company coming out with some private vaccine passport and that really catching a lot of steam and attention. And then that makes it harder to make things communicate across state lines, across borders.
Let me just read a comment from Paul, and then I do want to ask you about the pushback coming from some Republicans. Paul says, a privileged passport. Once again, poor people will be hurt by this. Not only will it be used for travel, but for concerts, big gatherings, possibly restaurants. So I think underscoring some of the concerns that, you raised earlier, Dan, a number of Republicans, and I would guess we're talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene and some others, Governor Ron DeSantis, who were talking about, you know, Big Brother, and somehow this is an outrage that we are talking about a vaccine passport. Where is this coming from?
Well, it's coming from long-held conservative fears of Democratic government overreach, and the fear also of privacy being violated and health data being given up to some Big Brother type. I will say I've talked to enough voters that I understand. I understand the fear of turning over private health data and the fear that if you don't have the right credential, you're not going to be allowed into certain places. I will say in my reporting, that is not what is happening. The Trump administration did not pursue the vaccine credential, but they were thinking on some similar grounds before Biden administration took over. Like this is a common thought among government. How can we best protect our people? And in the United States, there is no power from the administration to impose this, but that hasn't stopped Republicans from increasingly distorting what the Biden administration says it's doing. Some of those criticisms, Marty, I don't want to really give them airtime, but sure. They're dipping into really dark theories about religion and end of days rhetoric that this is not that. This is just a way for businesses and travel companies and others to figure out how they can be most safe in the middle of a pandemic.
Dan, we have a minute. I want to squeeze Nicole's question, and it was a question I had as well. She says, could COVID vaccinations be added to the yellow card already administered by the World Health Organization for diseases like yellow fever? I think you get a yellow card for diseases against like rubella and cholera and malaria. I mean, is that some potential thinking?
It's certainly possible. I know that one difference between that and these vaccine passports is that the vaccine passports, they're trying to make this a digital, discrete response to this pandemic. But I know that lots of options are on the table to best categorize vaccination.
Well, to be continued, right, Dan Diamond? Like all things political and health related in America. Thank you so much for joining us and getting our conversation started.
Thanks for having this University of Pennsylvania alum back on your program. I love WHYY.
Thank you so much. And that is Dan Diamond. He covers health policy and politics for The Washington Post. We've got two guests waiting in the wings talking on a related issue about the anxiety, I think, that a lot of people feel, and certainly some questions people have about how to re-enter the world as vaccines take hold, but also as cases continue to rise. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Last fall, the American Psychological Association warned that the pandemic was stressing out the public with potential harm to long-term physical and mental health. Earlier this month, the APA released a follow-up survey finding that their predictions came largely true. Many adults reported that they had gained weight, had trouble sleeping, and were drinking more in the last year. 48% of parents said that they were more stressed than they were before the pandemic. And while the vaccine rollout means that we are closer to some semblance of pre-pandemic life, about half of the adults said that they felt uneasy about adjusting to being with other people after the pandemic. Well, today on Radio Times, managing risks and anxiety in an uncertain world. And we have two guests who have joined us. Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. And joining us by Skype is Dr. Ellen Hendrickson. She's a clinical psychologist. She's on the faculty at Boston University's Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders, and she's the author of a book titled How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic and Rise Above Social Anxiety. And Dr. Ellen Hendrickson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Let me begin with you, if I could, Dr. Nuzzo, and just a quick response as an epidemiologist. What do you think of a vaccine passport?
I don't love the idea. I mean, I think it's one thing to talk about it in the United States, where we're going to have widespread access to vaccines. But what I don't love about it is the fact that there are still people who are quite hesitant about the vaccine. And I think the best path to overcoming that hesitancy is through education and dialogue and not necessarily requirements or restrictions. I think that would actually potentially increase mistrust and have people feel as though it's sort of a government-controlled endeavor as opposed to an incredible medical resource that we are offering people to protect themselves.
I mean, you're telling us there's just a lot of worry and suspicion out there.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes we try to shortcut that by just going to the requirements and to the restrictions. And I just feel like there's a lot more work that we need to do to communicate with people and to address those very, you know, understandable hesitancies that they may have. I think it's great that people have questions, and we have to make sure that we have enough opportunities to give them answers.
Let me turn to you, Dr. Hendrickson. And you know, it's been a year. We've been told to, you know, not venture out unless we are masked, to keep socially distant from others. Many people have lost their jobs. They've lost loved ones. When you think about it, it's just been a hellish 12 months that this country and obviously every other country in the world has been going through. Are we all suffering from some level of just kind of stress and uncertainty?
Absolutely. And anxiety is driven by uncertainty. And there's so much uncertainty right now. None of us has ever re-entered social life after a global pandemic before. And so we're all uncertain about how does this work, or am I doing this the right way? And when we layer that on top of the very real anxiety about the virus and its variants, or on top of mourning a loss, or just all the uncertainty that Americans are facing these days, it makes sense that we are all feeling some degree of anxiety.
Let me go back to you, Dr. Nuzzo, and you know, we've done so many shows about the pandemic, and they are very, you know, all very worrisome. But I do want to just take a moment to acknowledge the vaccine rollout program, and frankly, the successes that this country has had. And I'm curious, from your perspective, what are your thoughts? What are your feelings as more and more? I mean, literally every day, millions of people are getting vaccinated.
The rollout of vaccines and just the discovery and development of vaccines, I think, are a real point of light. There haven't been many in this pandemic, but the fact that we have now multiple vaccines that are all so very good at protecting us from illness, and we're increasingly having data that they're good at reducing transmission, I mean, this is an extraordinary development. The rollout also, I think, has exceeded expectations in terms of how quickly, and I think that's also a point that we should acknowledge the important progress that's been made. There are still, though, I think, areas of deficiency, and in particular, rolling out vaccines with respect to equity, making sure that all communities have equal access to vaccines. That's very much a challenge right now, and I don't want that to be lost in the total otherwise sort of good numbers.
Do you see efforts, at least, well, we hear the president, we hear others at least talking about equity. Do you see efforts to actually address that problem, to get to those neighborhoods where people need the vaccine?
I think there's been some slow and steady progress. I think there at least is a widespread acknowledgement of the need for it. I was pleased to see a discussion about providing resources to allow states to take vaccines to people, particularly maybe homebound elderly who haven't been able to, you know, make appointments and show up to be vaccinated. I think some of the pop-up vaccination clinics that a number of communities are doing in areas that may not be served by retail pharmacies, or where people may otherwise have a hard time getting a vaccine appointment, those are all great developments, but we just need more of it to make sure that the disparities that we're seeing right now are closed a bit.
I do want to play a clip from Dr. Rochelle Walensky. She's the new director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and she was speaking on Monday about sort of this moment that we're in as a country. On the one hand, we're still seeing cases, and in certain states and regions of the country, we're seeing increase in cases of COVID-19. And on the other hand, of course, we're having this vaccine rollout. Let me just play a clip, and then I want to get a response from both of you. And again, this is Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the director of the CDC.
I'm going to pause here. I'm going to lose the script, and I'm going to reflect on the recurring feeling I have of impending doom. We have so much to look forward to, so much promise and potential of where we are, and so much reason for hope. But right now, I'm scared.
Let me get a response from you, Dr. Nuzzo. I mean, there's so many ways to read that. And then she goes on to say, look, as a doctor, I know what it's like to care for COVID patients. I know what it's like to see them die, you know, without family close by. What was the message that she was sending out?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you take from that is it's been a very emotional year. It's been a tough year on everyone. It's been a tough year for the medical and public health communities that have, you know, served at the front lines. It's been a tough year for people who've lost loved ones or have feared the loss of loved ones. That, I think, is the overarching message that I take from it, as well as the fact that we are, I think, at a really important moment where we are so close to the finish line. Yeah. I am a bit more confident that we're going to get there. I don't have a sense of impending doom. I do think that the future is looking brighter than it ever has been. But, you know, there are still opportunities for loss here. And when you have a vaccine that can prevent people from dying, any death that occurs between now and the finish line is, in my view, an utter tragedy because it could have been avoided.
And to you, Dr. Hendrickson, when you hear that, and especially as a psychologist, what do you hear as the message coming from Dr. Walensky from the CDC?
Well, I know in my clinic, we have the longest waiting list we've ever had in the history of the clinic. And everybody is doing worse. So the folks who came in anxious are generally more anxious. The folks who were already fighting depression are feeling worse. And then even just in my circle of friends and family and colleagues, those who are not diagnosed with an illness or a disorder definitely identify with feeling some kind of lowercase S social anxiety or lowercase D depression as we move forward. It's been a tough year on all of us. And so I think Dr. Walensky's quote just reflects exactly that.
Do you think for some people, maybe people with social anxiety, that being home has been a safe place? I mean, a place where you don't have to, frankly, deal with a lot of other people.
Absolutely. Clients with social anxiety and also just people in my social circle who are familiar with social anxiety have said to me, I love this. I don't have to make awkward small talk at the company holiday party. I don't have to go to that conference and try to network. I don't have to stand awkwardly on the sidelines at my kids' sports events. But social anxiety is maintained by avoidance. And we have all been acting like we're housebound with social anxiety for a year. Rightfully so. We did that to stay safe in the midst of this pandemic. We've all been avoiding normal social life. But because we've all been avoiding and we're all out of practice, we're all rusty, it makes sense that therefore that anxiety has now bubbled up.
I mean, you're saying that we have to sort of learn how to be with other people again. I mean, if we're rusty, means we haven't been using those muscles, right?
Right, exactly. And I'm glad you used that word muscles, because an analogy I like to use, it's reopening and reentry is going to be kind of like getting a cast off. If you've ever broken a limb and had a cast, when you first get that cast off, your muscles have atrophied. But that doesn't mean that you should avoid your normal activities in perpetuity. It means that we should slowly get back in. We should slowly, you know, rebuild those muscles, and that will allow us to move forward into normal life and normal activities.
Let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation, and you can do it several different ways. You can send us an email, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. And a kind of open-ended question about, you know, how are you doing after a year of the pandemic? Do you feel comfortable venturing out, starting to restart your life, your level of anxiety? Maybe you're ready to embrace, you know, what you felt like you left behind. We do want to hear from you. Dr. Nuzzo, let me go back to you. And as an epidemiologist, how are you venturing out? I'm curious about how you have been, frankly, living your life.
Yeah, we haven't. I mean, we have.
You haven't.
Been
okay, fair
home.
Enough.
I mean, you know, my daughter goes to daycare and my son goes to school 2 days a week, and those are our main exposures as a family. Those are what we've prioritized. I have really, though, worried about the atrophy, and particularly in my children. So we've been trying to find outdoor activities that can still allow us to, encounter other people in a safe way so that my children can remember and learn and understand how you interact with strangers. So we've gone to the farmer's market and other things. But we've been doing that really just to, you know, ensure that my children can go to school safely and that there won't be any issues there. But I am looking forward to rejoining and to stepping out and partaking in the things that we once did. And my mental picture for that is that over the summer and certainly by fall, it'll feel much easier to do that.
I don't know if you're vaccinated or not, but if assuming once you get your complete vaccination, do you feel like, okay, I can take these baby steps and go outside and be with other people?
Yes. I mean, you know, from the perspective of someone who's vaccinated, you are now have really good protection against harm. I think there's a little bit of a messaging challenge these days because since the majority of us are not vaccinated, there still is a concern about maintaining the norms that we have had for the last year. So making sure that you still wear your mask and, you know, crowded spaces are just challenging from an overall public health perspective, although probably relatively safe for people who are vaccinated. But yes, I think it is, helpful for people who are vaccinated to realize that, you know, now they have some protection and they can think about their return life, even while perhaps being in public, still trying to adhere to some of the norms just because you don't know in a crowd who's vaccinated and who's not.
Sure, sure. To you, Dr. Hendrickson, picking up on what Dr. Nuzzo said about her children, and I'm thinking about, you know, children, school children, even younger, who, haven't had those social interactions that are so important to child development. What are some of your thoughts for parents and how to do this safely?
Yeah, well, I think we can inch our way into the pool. We don't have to do a cannonball into the deep end. And there are going to be dozens of points of reentry, both for adults and children. And I do want to say that given a level of safety, in a few months, many more people will be vaccinated and the level of threat will be lower. An important thing to remember about anxiety is that the anticipation is almost always worse than the thing that we are anxious about. So with social anxiety, for example, if we are anxious about, say, gathering with a few friends in a backyard, say we are vaccinated, you know, let's assume a baseline of safety, that anticipatory anxiety will be worse before we show up. And then once we do, the evidence and experience of being there will help refute the two lies of anxiety. The first of which is the worst case scenario is bound to happen. Our anxiety always goes to the worst case scenario. We scan for threat. And we don't want to be blindsided. It makes sense. It makes evolutionary sense. And the second lie of anxiety is I can't handle it, that I can't cope with whatever life throws my way. And so that's why the anticipation is always usually worse. And whereas when we show up, I'm sure you can relate to arriving at an event or finally doing a thing that you were worried about or procrastinating about and realizing, oh, that wasn't that bad. So again, assuming a baseline level of safety, the anticipation is much louder than a much louder alarm than we need to sound.
That is very helpful information. Let me get Harry to join our conversation. This is Harry on line one. And Harry, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning. I'm a person with with disabilities as well as chronic health problems. I found that other people who didn't have those concerns were more mobile, more able to get a lot more services than I received. Testing for the virus, I know a number of people that wound up going standing in lines. They were totally blind. They were handed forms, and they said to fill them out, and they gave them back to them. Say, what do you want me to do with this?
Wow.
So there's
wow.
a real downfall as far as sensitivity and as far as including us in the service delivery system.
Well, Harry, I appreciate your call. And actually, I'm going to give Dr. Hendrickson a chance to respond to the kind of isolation that Harry was experiencing because he's a person with disabilities. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. I think the community of people with disabilities has absolutely been disproportionately affected by the pandemic. And I think, like I said, that the folks with psychological challenges or, you know, diagnosed disorders are all, generally doing worse or experiencing extra challenges that I feel like the pandemic has really kind of poked us all in our respective pain points and really exacerbated whatever we were trying to manage beforehand.
And what for those people that are kind of isolated, we're almost about to break here, but further isolating them?
Yes, I mentioned that we've all been, you know, acting like we're housebound with social anxiety. We've all also been acting like we're housebound with depression in terms of not being able to have our usual social supports, do the things that we love. And so without those connections and ways of coping, it can absolutely affect us adversely.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dr. Ellen Hendrickson. She's a clinical psychologist. She's on the faculty at Boston University Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders. And she's the author of a book called How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic and Rise Above Social Anxiety. Also with us, Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo. She's an epidemiologist, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. Much more after this short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me just recap what we're talking about. Millions of Americans are getting vaccinated every day. States are easing restrictions, yet corona infections remain high, getting higher in some regions of the country. We're talking about how to determine how safe it is to return to quote unquote, a pre-pandemic life or a life with less restrictions. And again, our guests are Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo. She's an epidemiologist, and Dr. Ellen Hendrickson, who is a clinical psychologist. A lot of people calling us. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Nuzzo, going back to you, and you were talking about people who have been vaccinated or gotten the two vaccinations, if that's the requirement, that they can, you know, they can begin to go out into the world. Give us some of the do's and don'ts of that in as specifically as you can.
Well, so from a pure sort of medical perspective, I think people who have gotten fully vaccinated should feel quite happy that they've gotten fully vaccinated because they are now protected greatly from this virus. Right. Now, there are public health recommendations that the CDC has put out for vaccinated people, and they were actually published before we even had more evidence that vaccines help to not only protect people against illness, but potentially protect people against infection and therefore will reduce the spread of virus. Mm-hmm. I expect we will see new guidance from CDC now that we have a greater understanding that vaccines also help us reduce transmission. So right now, the guidance will say things like, you still shouldn't travel, but it's fine for a vaccinated grandparent to hug their grandchild.
Their unvaccinated grandchild, which is
correct.
Say.
Correct. Correct. You know, I think we're at this kind of awkward point right now where we still have dangerously high case levels each day. And we are seeing states do really, I think, unfortunate things like roll back all manner of public health restrictions, including mask mandates. We still need to wear masks in public. Even if you're vaccinated, you need to wear masks in public, mostly because we don't know who's vaccinated and who's not. And it's a very difficult compliance enforcement situation unless we just all comply. I don't think these things are forever, though. I think we are at this point right now where there's some manner of social norms that we have to adhere to until we get to a place where the majority of us are protected from this virus with vaccines and that we have much lower case numbers. That said, if you're vaccinated and you want to go see other vaccinated people, adults, that's fine. I don't particularly care if you go to, say, an indoor restaurant, something that I, as a not vaccinated person, wouldn't do right now. So I think you just will have some more freedoms, but it'll be so much easier in a couple of months.
Well, and just a follow-up question, almost the reverse. Looking at people who, frankly, flaunt some of these restrictions, they don't wear masks. You know, we all saw the spring break photos from Florida and other parts of the country where, frankly, a lot of people just in crowded bars and having fun and drinking and not wearing masks. How do you get a message to them? It's so easy to want to shame them. I mean, believe me, you know, you see, it just feels like arrogance and ignorance. But I don't think shaming is a good public health measure.
It's not. I mean, I think when shaming enters into the communication, it's probably a sign of frustration and a loss of other options. But it's just, I don't think it's an effective tool. And I think we have to continue to equip people with information to lower their risk. We can't assume that all people are going to fully abstain from everything. So we have to tell them what is the safest thing to do and give them some options.
How do you see that? I mentioned the word shame, which, of course, is such a powerful psychological position to be in. But Dr. Hendrickson, your thoughts about even messaging, about what do you think is effective way of messaging about safety and precautions?
Sure. I think shame and anger and frustration are never good delivery mechanisms for trying to get anyone to do what you want. None of us can remember the last time we approached somebody with anger or shaming and got a reasonable response. Likely we'll get a defensive response or an escalated response. So I think we should indeed stay away from the, you know, shame and frustration, even if that is indeed what we're all, you know, feeling when we see large groups of unmasked people, you know, flouting guidelines. I think it's important to use empathy and think about what might be effective, and to message based on what might resonate with them. Mm-hmm. Perhaps that if we follow guidelines, this will all be over sooner, or you'll be, you know, free to do what you want, in less time, or to, you know, think about your family members who might be at risk, to really use empathy to think about what might resonate with different people.
We got a lot of callers. Let me get, looks like Danielle, she's online too. Let me get Danielle to join our conversation. Hi, Danielle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I'm definitely relating to this whole social anxiety thing. I'm a young mom. I have a 2-year-old at home, and I'm just finding also that my trust with and my relationships with close friends have changed drastically over the course of this pandemic. Just again, that ability and that breakdown of trust, you know, again, with people who, again, I once was close with, that it definitely has taken a toll on those relationships, and so I just wanted to comment on that.
And just a quick follow-up, is it because you've been so separated, or you're finding that they're dealing with this pandemic in ways that are so different from yours?
So I am definitely more cautious, I feel like, than other people. But I don't think I'm unreasonably cautious. I feel like I'm like, okay, I'm just abiding by, you know, wearing a mask and, you know, and staying my distance. And I actually was part of a nanny share last summer, and we ended up leaving the nanny share. And ironically, the father caught COVID, and we were really close friends with them. And our relationship has just changed so much. Oh. And it's just kind of that, like, I don't know, they felt that we were being too cautious, and we felt that they weren't being cautious enough. So that's more of the reason. It's not even the distance necessarily. It's just our approaches.
Yeah, a falling out over that. It's a great question. And let me give Dr. Hendrickson a chance to respond. What do you say?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have experienced this shrinking of social circles, or at least a shifting of social circles. I've talked to many people who feel like they are closer to friends from their past. Maybe they've had started a weekly Zoom hangout with their college friends, but that especially over the winter, you know, in-person local interactions like going for a distance walk with a friend have really evaporated. But I think what the caller is talking about is a real laying bare of different values. And so that's a tough one that might be a deal breaker in a relationship, or it might be something that where the caller might find other ways to connect if there are shared interests or their kids remain friends. There's no easy answer to what happens when we have been shown to have fundamentally different beliefs or approaches to the world than our friends.
Let me read a Paul who asks, and I'll put this to you, Dr. Nazo, who says, we hear a lot about a new surge, but where are the infections? Are they among young people, older people? As you look across the country, what's driving some of the increased cases?
Well, one of the concerns is that we are seeing an increase in cases and even in some places some hospitalizations in, say, the 30 to 40 to 50 age range, mm-hmm. which somewhat makes sense because we have prioritized for vaccination people who are largely over the age of 65. And this is now a group of adults that is working, is out and about, has ample opportunities for exposure that have in many places so far not been prioritized for a vaccine. So it's going to be really important in the coming weeks to make sure that we also can extend vaccines to these people so that we can see a further drop in cases.
I'm thinking about schools, and I want to go back to you, Dr. Nazo, because you mentioned you've got two small children, and, you know, school districts in the Philadelphia area and frankly across the country have been just grappling with this. How do you get children back in the classroom safely? They're doing hybrid. Some are opening up their doors. Some are not doing that at all. I'm not asking you to advise school districts, but I think for parents, it's trying to figure out what is the best thing for my child.
Yeah, so for the earlier caller, we talked about, you know, feeling kind of distant from friends because of differing approaches to COVID. I mean, first of all, everybody's circumstances are different. Everybody's vulnerabilities are different. But everybody's values are different. And where we choose to, how much risk we're willing to absorb and for what purposes all differs. So I mentioned that, you know, our main exposures are sending my children to school. It's something that we as a family very much value, and we have prioritized that over, you know, socializing and other things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think the data show that it is possible to safely return children to school, provided that there are measures in place. And now increasingly the main population that we worry about in returning to schools is the adults in the school system, the teachers and staff. And in many places, they are now able to get vaccinated. So for families, then it's left with, okay, well, do you have a high risk adult in your household that may make you more cautious about sending your child to school for fear that even if it's low risk, perhaps it's not, enough of a, you know, too much of a risk for you to take that child could potentially bring home the virus. Yeah. Or even if you don't have a high risk adult, perhaps, you know, you think even though children have largely had, you know, the occurrence of severe cases in children is relatively rare, you may think any possibility of that happening is just not worth it.
Let me go pick up. Yeah, I'm sorry. Did you want to finish something?
No, just to say that you may not then send your child to school if that's the case.
Got it. To you, Dr. Hendrickson, I mean, risk. I mean, there's risk in life. And I mean, there's risk with a pandemic, and I'm not trying to minimize that in any way. But there are risks in driving a car. There are risks in taking a bath. You know, it's just trying to figure out, in a world that feels more risky than it used to be, how do you help us think through what that means?
Sure. So a hallmark of anxiety is that it is vague. Something bad will happen. What if something goes wrong? Anxiety is not particularly specific. So if we find ourselves feeling anxious, just that felt sense of anxiety or worrying, it helps to really specify exactly what we are worried about. Because then once the fear is specific, what if the kids in my kids' school don't want to wear masks? What if I get exposed on a city bus, on a ride that I'm taking for, you know, that last 10 minutes? Once we specify what it is exactly that we are anxious about, we can use our knowledge and our prefrontal cortex to question that anxiety and to try to come up with a plan and what we should do. In addition, anxiety often asks, what if? And it's very hard to argue with a question. So when anxiety does present itself as a what if, as a question, answer that question. You know, what if, again, like what if there's a kid at school who's not wearing a mask? Okay, what would we do? You could engage with your child or, you know, engage with your own mind and answer that question and determine, okay, well, what would we do in that situation? How would we cope? Again, anxiety is driven by uncertainty. And so by having a plan, having more information, having an answer to the what if and how would I cope, we can reduce that uncertainty and therefore reduce the anxiety.
How important is it to share our anxious thoughts and feelings with other people?
Well, I think it is important if we have boundaries, just like on a map. A boundary is something, is a limit, is something we are either willing to do or not willing to do. It is important to have clear communication around our willingness, given the risks and the, you know, the ever-changing risks as we move into more and more people being vaccinated. I think our boundaries will shift. At the same time, I think it is probably not appropriate to worry out loud to our friends and family, and instead to think about approaching. The opposite of avoidance is approach. I said before that anxiety is driven by avoidance. And so there are going to be dozens of points of reentry that perhaps that first time back on public transportation, that first time back in a restaurant, first time going into someone's home, and to remember that our mindsets can affect our behavior. So, you know, if we've ever made a New Year's resolution, we decide to eat healthy, we decide to work on our relationship, our behavior follows. But it can work the other way too. Our behavior can also affect our mindset. When we see ourselves avoiding people, our mindset recalibrates to match. We see ourselves isolating and decide that people, therefore, must be unsafe and therefore we'll avoid them more. And so as we start to reenter, and if we're feeling anxious, we can put action before confidence. Again, assuming this baseline level of safety, assuming that, you know, we are a few months out, more people are vaccinated, we're ready to reopen, we can put action before confidence and approach those points of reentry, even if we're feeling a little nervous, even if we're feeling a little rusty. And then once we see ourselves doing it, our confidence will catch up.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. That's Dr. Ellen Hendrickson, again, a clinical psychologist on the faculty at Boston University Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders, author of a book called How to Be Yourself. Dr. Hendrickson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Our pleasure as well. And Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. And as always, Dr. Nuzzo, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. Any questions or comments about the show, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. radiotimes at whyy.org. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.